It is Sunday, October 19th. I am your, we'll go ahead and say the starting quarterback for our Sunday pods. I am Zach Barnett, joined by John Bryce and Doug Samuels. Gentlemen, good morning.
Morning. Morning, ZB. Everyone knows that the most important quarterback play happens on Sundays.
That's true. That's where the big bucks are earned, and I'm going to try and earn them today. We had once again an eventful college football Saturday. Let's jump right into it. John, I think you are uniquely qualified to answer this question. Is there a fan base in college football with more contempt for another program than Tennessee has for Alabama after losing their 17th of 19 games to the Crimson Tide?
Probably not. It's a longer consecutive streak for the Vols versus the Georgia Bulldogs because they haven't beaten Kirby since the halcyon days of Butch Jones in 2016 when Juwan Jennings caught that walk-off Hail Mary and they found a way to blow that game at home. I would also argue that on this Sunday morning, because Tennessee baseball is getting ready to lose its manager Tony Vitello to the San Francisco Giants, that there's a bit more hatred for the Giants and the folks in the Bay than there is this morning for the Crimson Tide, because unlike Josh Heupel, Tony Vitello had actually delivered Tennessee a national championship.
Obviously, that game turned late first half on the 98-yard, basically 100-yard pick six. And one could say that that's a once-in-a-lifetime type play, but as we know, it's not, because Alabama scored on a very similar play in 2019. And it's just – if you're a Tennessee fan, I think you're either blood red when you see Alabama, or you just kind of pucker and turn tail, because that program owns Tennessee like none other. Obviously, as you mentioned, the Georgia has the consecutive streak, but we're going on two decades straight of dominance here.
Yeah, and the crazy thing is that before the past two decades, and two decades is no small measure of time, Tennessee had beaten Alabama more than any other SEC team. Tennessee, nobody in the SEC historically has a winning record against the Tide, but Tennessee had beaten Alabama even more than Auburn through the years. But once Saban arrived, that 2007 game is a game I actually covered, and Alabama had like five or six players suspended for a textbook scandal that day, and it was just announced 30 minutes before kickoff. And Bama opened the game with like an onside kick and absolutely blitzed Tennessee, and it's been a two-decade blitz since that time. So, yeah, there's extreme frustration for the Vols, and they still have Diego Pavia looming on their schedule. They still have Brent Venables and the Sooners looming on their schedule, and they still have a trip to Gainesville. And who the hell knows who will be coaching the Gators at that point in time, but Tennessee's House of Horrors in the Swamp is pretty similar to its overall House of Horrors with the Crimson Tide the last two decades.
And I think we can safely say Florida State 31, Alabama 17 will go down as the outlier result of the entire season. But I think we can also argue that Alabama, if you exclude week one, just enter that fantasy lane where we can do that, Alabama is comfortably the number one team in the country so far this season.
Yeah, I think they've figured out who they are. They've had receivers step up all over the place. I know Ryan Williams is one of the best receivers in the country, but Jeremy Bernard has been unbelievable. They've had guys step up. I know Jam Miller was I don't remember his name being called Saturday. Did he play?
Yes, he did.
Okay, yeah, but I know he's been kind of touch and go the past couple weeks with, I think he had a concussion last week and was out, but the Alabama defensively, they're starting to turn into who they should be. I remember it had to have been that Florida State game. Alabama had a player down at the goal line, number 18, get juked out of his shoes, I think, by Tommy Castellanos for a touchdown, and I didn't expect to see that dude on the field again, and he's been a mainstay and has completely turned around his season. But Alabama has figured out who they are, and I think they're one of the more dangerous teams in the country right now.
I think I saw the stat, and by the way, Jam Miller had a dozen carries last night, Doug, but only 15 net yards. So right. Tennessee didn't lose that game because of its run defense. But I think I saw a stat that what Alabama has done in winning four consecutive games against ranked teams had never been done by any SEC team without a bye week in there. So the Tide has done that. over the balance of a month without having a Saturday off. That's significant. And yeah, I think there's already been a lot of chaos in college football. The great thing is we know there's going to be more chaos over the remainder of this season. But I'm with you, Zach. I don't know how we don't get to the Heisman weekend and we reflect back on the regular season and say, how the hell did Florida State beat Alabama?
So over five straight games against the Power Five, Alabama has allowed 14, 21, 14, 24, and 20. So to your point, Doug, this isn't – they're not Ohio State's defense, but they're good enough that you're not going to get above 24 against them. And with the way they're clicking offensively, good luck holding them below 27. So that's definitely been a winning formula, to say the least, for Alabama. They get a bit of a reprieve. They're at South Carolina next week. And then after that, they're home against LSU, home against Oklahoma. So as of now, that would be six ranked opponents in seven games for the Tide.
And since you bring up South Carolina, I'll just note, I've already talked to some people in Columbia this morning, and the quote was, "It's bad, man. I'm telling you, it's bad over here. I don't see any way this doesn't end up a 4-8 or 5-7 season." So that's the mindset of where things are in the land of the Cockabooses. Shane Beamer entered this season with his highest ever preseason ranking. And much like some other teams we'll discuss and have already discussed, we're going to see South Carolina massively fail to meet those lofty expectations.
Yeah, that Oklahoma-South Carolina game was a showdown of resistible force versus resistible force. It was two of the worst rushing offenses in college football. And South Carolina lived up to its billing. I think they ran for 55 yards in their opening drive and finished with like 58 or something like that. But they allowed Torrey Blaylock, Oklahoma's freshman running back, to run for a career high 101. And that was enough for Oklahoma to win that game. And a game they certainly needed to have. Let's stay in the night window. John, you are uniquely qualified to answer this question as well. No one in the college football media has done a better job of chronicling, let's say, the interpersonal dynamics between the USC Notre Dame staffs. You own that story. So what does Notre Dame 34, USC 24 mean for both of these teams?
Don't take my words for it. Take the words that were shared with me from Marcus Freeman on the Notre Dame practice field Thursday, as the Irish kind of had their last major day before the Friday walkthrough. And that was, I'll slightly edit them, but he told his team, lock in, let's bleepity go. This is bleepity personal. So that's all you need to know. This was absolutely personal between Marcus Freeman, the Notre Dame head coach, Chad Bowden, the USC GM, as well as assistant GM Dre Brown, assistant athletics director Zaire Turner. All three of those are former employees of Freeman at Notre Dame. Chad Bowden built the roster in so many ways that beat USC last night. And Marcus Freeman had those guys fired up. He had them really dialed in. And as succinctly as possible, Notre Dame saved its season. That's what it boils down to. Notre Dame would have had its season end officially a week after Penn State's ended, after those two teams had met in the semifinals 9 months ago. But because Notre Dame found a way to win, despite having a first-time starting center, redshirt sophomore, who had never played meaningful snaps, they ran for 306 yards. They really turned this game around when they capitalized on Lincoln Riley getting a little too cute with some offensive calls. I see you nodding your head, Doug. Like, they were cooking last night. Like, Jaden Ma'ava was making it happen. He had just converted a huge third down play past midfield into Notre Dame territory. It was 27-24 game. And then they tried some gadgetry. And it was a horrific backfire, where Mekhi Lemon held on to the ball way too long. The receiver was open. I think it was Jacoby Lane. He kept holding on. Adon Shuler forced a fumble. Notre Dame recovered, scored a touchdown. That was blouses.
Yeah, I think Lincoln Riley, after the game, was asked about that one. He just said it was a stupid call, right? And that's one of them. I think the other one he got too cute on was the fourth and inches call. Down towards the end of the game, you know, they motion a guy out of the backfield to left side, and then they tried to do kind of a fake with a running back fast in the flats. That has been, you know, probably my most seen wrinkle on Twitter in the past 2 weeks. That you know, seems unstoppable, and Notre Dame just had it absolutely covered up and didn't allow it to get completed. But I mean, the Notre Dame running back said after the game, like, all wins go through the running back room. And I wish that was it should have been realized earlier in the season. And maybe this Notre Dame season has a different look. But we talked about after weeks one and two, those guys' touches were not enough. And I believe Love had two kick returns for touchdowns. Like, maybe don't kick the ball to that two special teams touchdowns on Saturday.
Price did. Price had 100-yard kickoff return for touchdown. And the two of them, Doug, great point. The two of them combined for 474 scrimmage yards. Just Jeremiah Love and Jadarian Price, 474 scrimmage yards.
They need to win every game here on out to even be in the conversation, and no win will be bigger than this one. But every game from here on out needs to go through the running back room. They're absolutely right. Like, saddle those dudes up and let's go.
I mean, we can criticize Lincoln Riley for trying to get too cute, but he's in a difficult position as a play caller. Lincoln Riley, the head coach, has put Lincoln Riley, the play caller, in a difficult position because he has to be nearly perfect. Because of the stat you just said, you gave up 474 scrimmage yards to two players. And USC, in these big games, I know they had a great game against Michigan last week, but when they go on the road, when they play big boy football, they consistently measure up short on the defensive side of the ball.
Yeah, I mean, look, they gave up 27 points on defense last night, USC did. And so that's well below Notre Dame's season average. They were really good in the red zone. I think Notre Dame only finished 4-for-7 in red zone scoring. And so you see, okay, well, they could have given up a lot more. You can look at that either way you want to. But I don't necessarily put last night's loss on the USC defense, because I thought that they did a lot of good stuff early. They forced some field goal attempts. They were very much bend but don't break. And again, USC had rallied to a 24-21 lead after the two-point conversion when Jadarian Price uncorked his 102-yard kickoff return. And that is the last two times that Notre Dame has played SC in South Bend, Jadarian Price has had a 100-plus yard kickoff return. And then last year in LA, Notre Dame had two different 100-yard defensive pick sixes. So you want to talk about chunk plays, that's all the real estate you can have is a 100-yard play.
The big game of the day was Ole Miss at Georgia, and this was a shootout until it wasn't. Georgia in winning time has been a key theme of mine, obviously, for these last many years. How about this? Ole Miss, 35 points through three quarters, 13 yards in the fourth, and a 17-0 Georgia landslide in the fourth quarter. What do we make of this one, gentlemen?
I mean, to me, that fourth quarter, Ole Miss seemed like a completely different team, and Georgia turned it up and found a way to win. I think I had heard during the broadcast, Trindad Chambliss went 1-for-10 in the final quarter. Georgia covered up some of the deep and over the middle routes, forced Trinidad to go to checkdowns into the boundary, and those were either too hot for the receiver to handle or were corralled behind the line of scrimmage. So Georgia finds a way to win in the fourth quarter is really what this comes down to. They really turned it up. I thought they were really impressive. Trinidad had a great three quarters. He needed all four of them for Ole Miss to have a shot, and he just didn't have the magic in the fourth quarter.
Could not agree more, Doug. I think that's a great point, because it's also what Georgia did to win last month in Knoxville in a game that Tennessee consistently led by double digits and led by 14 very early, 21-7, led by 10 later on, led by 10 in the fourth quarter. Georgia finds a way to force overtime, wins the game in overtime. And it's also a little bit of what the MO is now for Lane Kiffin and Ole Miss. They can't quite get over that one hump. Like, yes, they beat Georgia at home last year. They still don't have a win against Alabama since Kiffin arrived, unless I'm mistaken. I don't think that I am on that one. And Georgia just flat out dominated the fourth quarter when it shouldn't have been that way, because Ole Miss had outplayed and outcoached Georgia for three quarters and had more than a touchdown lead. And when you take more than a touchdown lead into the fourth quarter in that kind of game, you have to find a way to bring it home. You know, and Ole Miss just finishes with barely 350 yards. As you noted, they had like 340 through the third quarter, and they finished with like 351. And then Ole Miss had dominated time of possession in the first half and really through three quarters. And then Georgia ends up with a 15-minute edge in time of possession, like 37.5 to 22.5. And then Georgia ends up with over 500 yards of offense. An overall very clean game. Neither team committed a turnover, only three penalties for one, four for the other one. It was good football. I left that game, watching that game, convinced there's not great teams in college football this year. Ohio State is really good. Indiana looks to be really good. But there's not a great team in college football, in my opinion.
Gunnar Stockton's been kind of the lightning rod throughout his career as we kind of litigate what he is. Well, yesterday, he was a stud. 41 total touches between the air and the ground. And he counted for as many touchdowns as incompletions. Four touchdown passes, one on the ground, five incompletions, 26 of 31, 289 yards. Georgia to me has kind of been a team that plays hard when they have to, and when they have to, they've typically been good enough against Alabama. They had to play hard that entire game because it was a shootout from the jump, and they had enough to win. And they're top five team for me.
They are. Here's what I think is very striking, and this sounds a little weird to say: they're not dynamic on the defensive line. And it feels weird to say. To talk about dynamics on the D-line, but how did Georgia win consecutive national titles? It was absolutely littered with NFL players on its defensive line, guys that could cause havoc in the interior and guys that could kill you off the edge, and they just don't have that. And so all credit to Georgia, especially for the way it won at Tennessee and the way it found a way to save its season yesterday. Also, complete credit to them, but this Georgia team just does not strike me as particularly dynamic on the defensive side of the ball, and that's just not what Kirby Smart has been known for.
I should amend my statement. I have them ranked number six this morning. Ohio State, Indiana, A&M, Alabama, Georgia. Let's stay in the SEC. One team that's not going to be in anyone's top six moving forward is LSU. But let's start with Vanderbilt after that 31-24 win. They were underdogs by ranking, but favorite in Vegas. The Alabama win is the Alabama win they had last season. But this one puts them at 7-1. So in a way, I think this is more satisfying to go out and get this one than the shock factor of beating Alabama. Do you guys think I'm crazy for that statement?
6-1, I believe. 6-1.
Okay. Yeah, 6-1.
No, there's just more authenticity, I think, to what this Vanderbilt team is doing, or there's more legitimacy, I should say, to it. It's no longer a fluke. And look, Alabama ended up pulling away from the doors last week, but Vanderbilt led that game early, and Vanderbilt was right where it needed to be at halftime, and then Alabama just found a way to pull away. But they've already, you know, won at Virginia Tech. They've won at South Carolina when South Carolina was still relatively healthy and still ranked in the top 12. And then to win this game at home, you know, you guys know it. Our boss lives in Baton Rouge, and he called me on Friday, and he was like, Bryce, people down here are just upset that LSU is an underdog to Vanderbilt. I don't know what happens if LSU actually goes and loses. And, you know, Diego Pavia was the X factor. And actually – the home crowd was an X factor for Vanderbilt, which is, I don't know, maybe it's the first time in my life I've said that, because the home crowd was stunned that they beat Alabama last year, but the home crowd was a factor in beating LSU yesterday.
I think that nails it for me though, JB. Like when that went against Alabama, you know, you could be really happy with it, but be considered kind of a fluke in the grand scheme of Vandy football. And to now have a top 10 team in your backyard at your home stadium and be able to knock them off says everything about what Clark Lee has done there. Like, it's become the expectation. It's the expectation in Vegas. It's the expectation in the Vandy locker room. It's the expectation because guys like Diego Pavia, Jerry Kill, and Coach Beck are there. Like, that is a huge statement on the where Vandy football is right now, and might be something we – you know, I mean, we're witnessing two of the best coaching jobs in college football in our lifetime, in my opinion, in Clark Lee and Kurt Cignetti. I mean, to turn around programs like Vandy and Indiana is unbelievable. And Clark Lee needed some time to do it. Cignetti didn't need all that time to do it. But nonetheless, it's two of the best coaching jobs in college football history.
I think that's a great point, Doug. Like, that's an outstanding point by you. I'm not going to assign you additional work because you're my boss anyway, but it would be a great story for you to write about. Like, the perspective of that you've brought now for multiple weeks and being on the front end of what Cignetti is doing and now tying it with Clark Lee is probably the most confounding story of college football this decade. For the talk about NIL, for the talk about the transfer portal, for the talk about all the coaching changes and rev share and everything else, there's still nothing more stunning than Vanderbilt being a top 15 team and Indiana being a top 3 team. Like, it's absolutely mind-boggling to me. And you guys probably get tired of me talking about time of possession, but Vanderbilt was on the field 13 minutes more than LSU. And when you have probably not as talented a roster top to bottom, a great way to win is not to let the other team's offense on the field. And Vanderbilt did a fantastic job of that. And that's why I contend as this Penn State search winds along, I'm just telling you, I think that Clark Lee could end up getting a look in Happy Valley.
While I agree with you on some time of possession, I also agree time of possession is maybe the most overrated stat in football, but you have a point. But in this particular case, if you give that LSU offense the ball for another 13 minutes, I'm not sure much changes. That's how disappointing they've been on the offensive side of things this year.
That's fair. And it should be noted that final score was 31-24, but Vanderbilt was taking a knee on LSU's doorstep. I mean, that was a 38-24 game. That was a double digit win in every sense of the word, except the scoreboard for the Doors.
This game does not deserve to be mentioned, except for the fact that it's been a significant source of controversy on this podcast. So I'm going to go ahead and mention it now against my will, but it's my journalistic duty to mention Texas 16, Kentucky 13 in overtime. And one of this mentioned that this is a very possible Texas loss, and the offense did everything they could. A record-setting display of futility, 8 first downs, 179 yards of total offense, 47 rushing yards, but the defense and the special teams refused to comply, and the Longhorns escaped with an overtime win that was – I saw Bill Connolly put out that Texas had a 16% post-game win expectancy, and it looked like that in real time as well. I mean, this was ugly as ugly gets.
The first down stats are insane. The total offense is insane. Not just being held under 180 at 179 and giving up 395 to Kentucky. My favorite bizarro stat from this game is the fact that Kentucky had 86 offensive plays and Texas had 55 and Texas won the game.
I mean, so, I don't think anything summarizes this game better than this. The fact that it's 10-10, you get a huge punt return set up where you basically just need 2 first downs to kick a field goal and win the game. And then they get a 9-yard completion to DeAndre Moore to set up a 3rd-and-1, but he runs out of bounds to single-handedly keeping Kentucky in the game. But Texas could overcome their own mistake by converting a third and one with the quarterback run game. You keep the ball at the quarterback to get the +1 advantage on the ground. The offensive line gets 0 push, so you have to kick a field goal on 4th-and-1. Your defense allows Kentucky to march the field, kick a field goal. In overtime, your defense gets a literal game-saving goal line stand. And then on offense, all you have to do is just not screw it up. And then they immediately get a holding penalty to take themselves out of field goal range. And they're kicking a field goal on 4th-and-12 to go win the game from the 27 on a drive that started on the 25. And Mason Shipley's good enough. And Texas looks like a character in The Walking Dead because they're just waiting to be eliminated from SEC championship contention. But technically, they're still in it.
Yeah, the goal line stand for the Texas defense, the goal line failure for the Kentucky offense is really the epitome of Kentucky football in recent years. And now that's nine consecutive SEC losses for the Cats. It's something like 14 out of 15 overall in SEC play that they've lost now. We would be talking about Kentucky a lot more if it wasn't for Florida State and Florida State's ACC futility. But the Bush Hamden experience running the Kentucky offense continues to be an unmitigated disaster. He's 20 plus games in now, or 20 games in, and his offenses have never scored more than two touchdowns against any other power conference team, period. So
Kentucky's averaging 15 points per game against SEC foes. Like that's not going to win you SEC games. And when Mark Stoops is 31 and 66, I think, in SEC play as a head coach, you need a lot more than 15 points to be able to compete in that league.
It's 10:29 God's time as I'm saying this. And as of now, there have been no coaching changes. Do we think that holds throughout the end by 10 p.m. tonight?
Absolutely not.
No. I've already got other people texting me if the over-under today on coach dismissals is 1.5, and I probably would take the over, and I would start by training my telescope southward to Gainesville and northwestward to Madison, Wisconsin. And I think those are the two epicenters for Carousel Sunday this week. And then there's some others that you definitely cannot rule out. The heat continues to absolutely intensify in East Lansing, and nothing that happened this weekend will dissuade that. That's just, for whatever reason, been a really bad fit.
I was going to set the over-under at 1.5 as well and take the over. And the two schools that I had in mind, you did not even mention there. So perhaps 1.5 is too late. But let's go to the ACC. Louisville upsets Miami on Friday night. I would sit here and say, well, the ACC put its school, its favorite team in a disadvantage by having them play on the road on Friday night. But this one was at home, and Miami was off last week. So both of those excuses are out the window.
Yeah, Miami's inability to run the football in that game, and we've been raving about them on both sides of the football all season long, and I think they ran for just over 60 yards in the game. Then afterwards in the game, I think Carson Beck was asked about one of his picks, and you know, essentially threw his receiver under the bus for running the wrong route or having a miscommunication or something. That's not what you want to see out of your veteran starting quarterback. You know, a freshman quarterback maybe does something like that. But, you know, credit – and I think we said it on Thursday's pod. One of us, might have been me, mentioned Jeff Brohm just has a knack for winning games that he shouldn't, at least one a year, dating back to, you know, Purdue. And, you know, when you look at what he was able to do in West Lafayette, it's really impressive now after the last two head coaches with Barry Odom there and them losing this week to Northwestern. But, you know, can the question for me is, can Jeff Brohm win a national title at Louisville? I'm not so sure. We just talked about where the Periscope is focused, and I'm not saying that Jeff Brohm is a candidate for any other job. But if I'm Penn State and I want someone that could win football games and develop a quarterback, like Jeff Brohm is in that conversation. I don't know if Louisville is considered Midwest. That's kind of pretty south, and I know that's where his roots are. But you know, for a guy with some Midwest roots and some Midwest success, Jeff Brohm would be on my list if I were Pat Kraft.
Well, here's what that win did. Two things. Carson Beck throwing the guy under the table. You say only a freshman does that. Only a freshman, or maybe Tua Tagovailoa, since he did it last weekend for the Dolphins. So it must be a South Florida quarterback thing that you throw your teammates under the bus. Also, if that's your first interception of the game and you've thrown for 400 yards and you've been dazzling, you can probably have a little more equity, even if it's ill-advised, to throw your teammates under the bus. When it's your fourth interception, maybe show some humility. I don't know. I'm talking crazy, I guess. But big game Brohm strikes again. You did say it, Doug. And I didn't necessarily think Jeff Brohm didn't have that capacity. I just didn't think it would be Friday night, you know, in Hard Rock Stadium when Miami had had so much time to prepare and had so much to play for. Now the Cardinals are identical 5-1 as Miami is, and looking at Louisville's schedule, they're probably going to be favored in every single game the rest of the way, with the potential exception of maybe being a slight underdog at SMU in late November. But they're through the worst of their schedule. They had that, they were down 17-0 against Pitt and rallied to win that game. And Pitt looks a lot better than I certainly thought that the Panthers were, especially now that they've found a revelation in their freshman quarterback. So it's not just big game Brom and getting a scout midway through the season. It's the fact that now Louisville re-enters the ACC title race, which means Louisville re-enters the college football playoff conversation.
This is from the I'm not saying, I'm just saying department. Where did James Franklin struggle at Penn State? Developing, identifying and developing quarterbacks, winning big games. Jeff Brom, quarterback guy. He's getting something out of Miller Moss that even Lincoln Riley did not get. And according to the NCAA, Jeff Brom is 4-0 in the regular season against AP top five teams.
Well, I've seen a couple of those in person because 2018, I covered Ohio State at Purdue, and that was an Urban Meyer coach team, and Purdue beat them 48-20, I think it was, and just absolutely walked the Buckeyes all night long. And I think Schiano was still defensive coordinator then for the Buckeyes, and Ohio State was obviously loaded with talent and had so much to play for coming into that game, and Purdue just paddled their booties.
We are over 30 minutes in, and we haven't even mentioned a wild day in the Big 12. Texas Tech had played like the closest thing to a perfect team we've seen through the first half of the season. No one had come within 20 points of them until Arizona State did. And Arizona State built a lead, gave it up, and then got it back with a heroic touchdown drive to go win that game. Texas Tech, Baron Morton, their starting quarterback, seems like he's one of those dudes that's in it, unavailable more than he's available. And it finally caught up to them yesterday when Will Hammond played like a backup redshirt freshman quarterback, making his first start on the road.
Yeah, Texas Tech had been averaging over 560 yards of total offense with Baron Morton pulling the trigger. And Saturday, they managed about 275 yards. So to say he is vitally important to that operation is perhaps the understatement of college football.
He's just, if Tech's going to live up to where this season can go, he's got to find a way to stay healthy. And speaking of where this season could go, the shine off BYU's visit to Lubbock here in a couple weeks was taken a little bit off, but BYU did its part in fending off Utah 24-21 in a beautiful, absolutely beautiful color versus color game at Lavelle Edwards Stadium last night.
Yeah, the decision to reallow, I don't even know if that's a word, those teams to both wear their home uniforms regardless of where the game is, and then to have the backdrop each time with the mountains and snow-capped already, that's beautiful. That's art, college football style, and credit to BYU. I thought that Utah would be the more mature physical team over four quarters. Utah briefly took a 14-10 lead, I think it was, and then BYU responded basically to put the game away and took a 24-14 lead. Utah got a late score in desperation mode, but BYU predominantly controlled that game and really showed me a lot. Like I think I used this line on this podcast before. Nobody should tell Bear Bachmeier what his flaws are, that he's not that good, because he doesn't understand what his flaws are, and he thinks he's really good, and he's playing like he's really good. And he's as tough as any quarterback in college football. He's living up to the Bear moniker.
Yeah, you have to be tough to be a quarterback wearing number 47. And, I mean, I agree. He doesn't know what he doesn't know. He's as hard-nosed of a runner with the biggest baby face I've probably ever seen. I don't know how many BYU games you have to watch to get used to seeing a number 47 with that face taking snaps and being physical running the football, but that's a Kalani Sitake team right there. It is his DNA that shows up, hard-nosed defense, being able to run the ball when everyone in the stadium knows you're going to run it. And then Bachmeier does just enough with his arm to keep you honest, and BYU can have a really special season with that recipe.
I think they're now 7-0, if I'm not mistaken, which means they're now 17-3 in their last 20 games. That's pretty freaking good. That's about as good, literally, as anybody anywhere in college football not named Ohio State.
And I feel like I'm due for my second apology of the podcast season. I had to apologize to Matt Patricia after week one that I didn't know if he was cut out to be a college defensive coordinator. And I believe I said on Thursday that BYU's 6-0 start was relatively hollow, to steal words out of your mouth, JB. They proved it on Saturday, man. They proved that they are legit, and you better come ready to play.
The folks in Cincinnati are either screaming at their devices that we haven't mentioned them yet, or they're screaming at their devices that we are mentioning them right now. But they are tied for first place in the Big 12 with the quietest 4-0 in the history of 4-0 starts in conference play. They hammered Oklahoma State yesterday. Not that that's that hard to do, but they've got a tougher stretch coming up with Baylor at home. Then they're at Utah, and BYU comes to the Queen City later on this season. No, Queen City's Charlotte. I don't know, the Spaghetti City of Cincinnati. I don't know what their real nickname is. Moving on.
Well, they're both Queen Cities. They are. Yeah, my dad grew up in Cincinnati, and I would note that on the Bearcats, you're right. The win against Iowa State made me a believer. Scott Satterfield's got him 6-1 after we've discussed on this podcast. He was nearly run out of town last December. Cincinnati put a bunch of stuff out last night into this morning about being bowl eligible, and Scott Satterfield was in the locker room post-game talking about, we're going bowling, now let's keep going so we get to go to one of the really good bowls. I didn't love that. Don't talk about bowling. Talk about the fact that you're in the playoff race, or don't talk about it at all. Just focus on next week. So I didn't love the going bowling. I saw it from them and somebody else this morning. Oh, Virginia. Virginia, you're freaking first place in the ACC. Don't dwell on the fact you got a safety to cap an insane comeback against middling Washington State to win 22-20. I understand it's progress. Stay in the moment, in my opinion. Doug knows so much better than me. But I just didn't like the going bowling stuff from those two teams. I thought it was unnecessary. You're bigger than that. You've already proved you're bigger than that. You don't need to tell everybody you're bowl eligible.
But when you're a head coach that enters the season on the hot seat, you know, the proverbial hot seat, you've got to celebrate stuff like that. Like we might not like how they did it, but when you flip the script, you've got to celebrate the little moments. The other team that I saw kind of celebrating that's maybe a little more fitting was Timmy Chang's program at Hawaii. You know, they were, you know, bottom of the league and considered, you know, written off or dead for a long time. For those guys to celebrate going to the bowl, which to me, you're leaving Hawaii to go to a bowl. You might be in the famous Idaho Potato Bowl or something like, you know, who knows where you end up. You want to play at Hawaii, but for them to get bowl eligible, I think is a big deal.
That one is. You're exactly right. And they've got some real wins this year. I mean, they beat Stanford earlier. They've been a factor in their conference. Another impressive, I think, road win yesterday. So, the Rainbow Warriors bowl eligible. 6 wins already. Go figure. 6 wins for Hawaii, while Florida State still seeks its first ACC win.
How about this? UAB ended the nation's longest active winning streak in game one under interim head coach Alex Mortensen. I mean, that might be the result of the day, pound for pound.
I feel like the success of interim head coaches early on may be giving some AD some itchy trigger fingers. Like, hey, maybe we can make a change right now and win some games. I think there might be a contingent of non-UCLA fans that think that Jerry Neuheisel is the interim head coach and it's not Tim Skipper right now, based on all the play that Coach Neuheisel's getting, and Jerry deserves it. Like, he's done a great job with that offense and flipping it around. But you know, they've won 3 in a row under Tim Skipper. Let's not forget that. I was really happy for Alex Mortensen to get that. Wish his dad would have been around to see that one. Would have been really cool. Maybe he had the best seats in the house from you know, the clouds, but really emotional win for them. And I don't think anyone expected them to beat Memphis, which has been the toast of the group of five all season long.
Yeah, and as Zach alluded to, Memphis had an incredible winning streak that dated back to last year. They had everything in front of them in terms of playing for that G5 playoff spot and being in the best position to play for that G5 playoff spot. Just a really poor loss for the Tigers and their first loss to UAB in 14 years.
Wow. Doug, to your point, I don't know who it's from, but I saw a graphic of a UCLA win from one of the national networks, I don't know who, that had Tim Skipper's photo on it. So I was like, oh, they do know who the actual head coach is. Maybe all that noise had gotten to them. But, yeah, I'm with you. It was a little bit uncomfortable, the shine that Jerry Neuheisel was getting. So I was relieved to see that they actually recognized the head coach in this situation. John, you mentioned this. Do we think they're imminent – changes in your opinion at Florida State or Auburn, who were both of those teams looking for their first or conference wins, excuse me?
I think there's going to be a freeze out on the Plains. Is it today? I haven't studied their schedule enough, but in talking to enough people, I think it's now inevitable. And that was an imminently winnable game for Auburn yesterday. They were up 17-10 at home. They keep finding ways to lose instead of finding ways to win. They keep finding ways to be the second worst offensive team in the SEC behind only Kentucky. At home, chance for not a signature win, but, you know, a facsimile win against a Missouri team that's ranked and well-regarded this year, and you just find a way to not get it done. And you're up 17-10. And then you can't do anything in a couple of overtimes and you end up losing 23-17. And I'm confused that it's not worked out, but it has just not remotely come close to working out for Hugh Freeze in this go around back in the SEC. And it's now there's talent on the roster. That's the thing that, like, I'll always defer to people smarter than me. And there's a whole bunch of them. But when I talk to NFL scouts or some NFL assistants, or even other coaches around college football, they're just like, what is Auburn doing? Like, they've got players. They've got players, and they can't find a way to put it all together to make enough plays to win a game of substance on the weekends.
I was told a long time ago by a family member back well before I was married, like, you don't break up with your girlfriend unless you have a backup option. And I feel like ADs need to hear that advice. Like, if you're Penn State, you don't make a move on James Franklin unless you got the next guy lined up. And maybe they do, but if I'm Pat Kraft and I make that move, like, I give Kurt Cignetti everything that he wants. For Auburn, like, who are you going to hire better than Hugh Freeze? I think Hugh Freeze is a really good football coach that has come up short for whatever reason. But I know every coach has their – or every AD has their list in the top drawer of their office, right, of your top five guys. You better be able to go get one of those guys, because if you don't, you're going to be paying for it with your job too. So that's got to be at the forefront of athletic directors' minds at this point. Like, if you're going to break up with your head coach, you better have plans in place to hire someone a whole lot better. And we're talking about a bunch of blue bloods being open. You're going to be paying a big buyout. You're going to be paying up big time for the next head coach. You better know who the heck you're bringing in order to make a move like that.
What about a James Franklin? You're not paying a buyout there. I mean, he's won a boatload of football games. He's won more than either of the last couple Auburn coaches. And you don't have a buyout. I don't know. James Franklin made it abundantly clear he wants to get back into coaching. Auburn would have viewed James Franklin as a good hire 2 years ago, probably 1 year ago. Honestly, James Franklin would probably be the coach at Florida right now if Florida had made its move a year ago with Billy Napier that seems imminent now. So crazy how quickly the sport changes. And you're right, Doug. This is shaping up to be the carousel of the decade, if not the carousel, the biggest carousel of the 2000s.
Yeah, I'm already feeling we had a reader send us in his own fantasy nuclear winner. I'm going to have to outdo myself with what's coming already. We're 45 minutes in. Give me a result from the weekend that we have not mentioned that you feel like merits mention. I'll go ahead and start since I put you guys on the spot.
Yeah,
I have two. Number one, SMU getting a revenge win for the ACC championship at Clemson. Obviously, Clemson's nowhere near the team we all thought they were going to be. But if you're SMU and you go on the road and beat the blue blood of the blue bloods within the ACC, that's satisfying. And then TCU beating Baylor at home to get a win in the rivalry. I believe that's 9 out of 11 for them. I didn't think they would play good enough pass defense to slow down Sawyer Robertson. They gave up 36 points, so they slowed him down just enough. And that one was one of those where they had a weather delay. They went in the locker room for like an hour, came out and played 2.5 minutes of football, then went back in the locker room for a second time, then came back out and had to finish the game. Both of those weather delays happened in the fourth quarter. So a mental toughness win for Sonny Dykes and the Horned Frogs.
I'll go with two here. One of them I think I talked about on Thursday's pod. Minnesota just absolutely walked Nebraska, and that was 24-6. Almost doesn't do the dominance justice. And maybe you just study that 14-play, 98-yard drive that Minnesota had that not only ended in a touchdown but ended with its ownership of Nebraska's soul. So that's a big one for me. Jared Parker and Troy moved to 5-2. Their 37-14 win at ULM, that's significant. And one of those losses was at Clemson when they led that game 16-0 early in the season, maybe week two. So those are a couple. FCS style, Presbyterian and Tennessee Tech remain undefeated. I think both of those teams now maybe have college football NCAA Division I's longest winning streak. I know the Blue Hose of Presbyterian have won at least 11 in a row. Tennessee Tech is 7-0. They won their final three or four games a year ago. So both of those teams, I probably use the word unprecedented too much, but it is unprecedented success for Presbyterian and Tennessee Tech. They're doing it in remarkably different ways. Presbyterian, not a scholarship school. Tennessee Tech, getting Bobby Wilder, who built Old Dominion from the ground up. So a lot of kudos to those two teams, as well as the aforementioned FBS teams.
I got a few quick ones before touching on a few lower level games. Bob Chesney and James Madison just absolutely thumping Old Dominion. And Old Dominion beat Virginia Tech and arguably cost Brent Pry, was the straw that broke the camel's back for Brent Pry. So Bob Chesney continues to build an impressive resume with the Dukes. UConn beating the Bill Belichick coaching tree at Boston College, dropping Bill O'Brien to, I think, 1-6 on the year. Not great things happening at Boston College. Bill O'Brien was, said in his postseason presser, like he doesn't know what's going on. So he's got to figure that out. Then at the small college level, Battle of the Valley, Saginaw Valley beat Grand Valley State, I believe a top 5 or top 10 program in Division II. 20-19 after a couple of Scott Wooster's gambles didn't pay off for the Lakers. That's a big win at the Division II level for Ryan Brady and the Cardinals. And then something I'll be writing on here either today or early tomorrow, a three-year losing streak at the Division II level comes to an end as Northern Michigan ends their three-year losing streak, something like 25 games or something like that, beating Roosevelt University in the Chicagoland suburbs. Pretty handily. And when we talk about Northern Michigan's three-year losing streak, a handful of those losses for the Division II program in the Northern Woods of Michigan were to Division III programs at places like Alma. That's a really good top 25 Division III program. They hadn't won in a long, long time. For them to get a win is really big for the Wildcats.
We have a story up on the site of Division III running back Curry College's Monty Quinn set the NCAA record for single-game rushing yards, ran for 522 yards, 7 touchdowns. And if that wasn't impressive enough, he did it on 20 carries. So sorry to all the Division I coaches out there, but he's a senior. So he's going to be out of eligibility after this season. But shout out to him. That's it for us. Thank you all for joining us. We'll be back Tuesday with the full squad. Enjoy your weekend.